Blog Talk Radio.
Mama Africa, Mama Africa, am I coming home, hello Mama Africa, how are you? I'm feeling fine, and I hope you're fine too. Hello Mama Africa, how are you? I'm hoping you hear these words, your grace turned blue, grace turned blue. I'm saying these words to let you know how much I care, and I won't let go, even oceans away, you're with me day by day. Memories of you keep flashing through my mind. The very thought of you makes my time. Hello, Mama Africa, how are you? I'm feeling fine.
If not in me, then you see me in you.
Hello, Mama Africa, how are you? I'm feeling fine, and I hope you're fine too. Hello, Mama Africa, how are you? I hope when you hear these words, your grace turn blue.
Mama Africa, welcome to another edition of Your World News. I'm your host, Solomon, and once again, joined by Peter Fowler, live from Glendale, Arizona. He'll be joining us in a moment, but I just want to welcome you on this very fabulous day, and I say a fabulous day because it's a great day to fight and to struggle and to resist. Not a fabulous day based on the fact that there are so many unnecessary issues that exist throughout the world, you know, based around neocolonization, based around imperialism, based around greed, capitalism. I'm not even going to say unfettered capitalism because that makes it seem like capitalism actually has a heart. If you say unfettered capitalism, it makes it seem like capitalism gives a damn about the ordinary person. you know, the proletariat, if you will, the working class. It doesn't. So, but it's a great day to fight. And I'm live here from Washington, D.C. metropolitan area. And like I said, we've got a great edition for you. This February, what day is it? February 25th, 2010. And a lot of things to discuss, We're in the midst of Black History Lifetime. And so we'll be speaking about resistance, heroes of resistance within the African community, and a number of other things. But as usual, we're gonna start off with a couple news pieces, and you're all welcome to call in. The call-in number, as you know, is 347-945-5191. That's 347-945-5191. If at any moment you feel compelled to call into the show to issue your comments or your question, you are definitely encouraged to do so. And so I'd like to get Peter to chime in, introduce himself, and after he does, we're gonna hit the ground running. We're gonna cover a few news pieces that are of note. As you guys know, today was the healthcare summit that the White House hosted, and a lot of things to talk about. What was discussed there and what was not discussed, who was there and who was not invited. It's just amazing that this battle still wages. And just to think, just a couple years ago, it started off as a possible dialogue towards leading towards a hopeful single payer or so-called universal health care, and it quickly whittled down and watered down to what we came to know as the public option, and that was taken off the plate. And now we have these healthcare summits, and I don't think that even once this bill passes, because even when you look at Obama's bill and the White House's bill, seemingly it's going to leave off out at least 23 million Americans, and we know that every year between 23,000 and 44,000, depending on which studies and which research you look at, people die unnecessarily because of the absence of health insurance. So we'll talk about that and all that stuff. And so Peter's with us now from Glendale, Arizona. Peter, do you want to chime in, let the folks know who you are, and you know, how they may get in contact with you once the show's over, if they so please.
Yeah, good evening, Solomon. It's good to be with you again, and there's definitely much to talk about, as you have just mentioned. Yeah, Peter Fowler from Glendale, Arizona, and currently working on the Academy of Critical Thinking. So you can reach me at peter.fowler@theacting.org, or also at peter.fowler@yahoo.com. And Solomon, by way of introduction, I'm not going to talk about my degrees or my professional experience, but because of the conversation that was held in Washington today and that has been ongoing in Washington and throughout this country for a year now on healthcare, I just want to say that I am one of the millions of folks who are without healthcare at this very minute, and I have a health condition. And so because my country refuses to provide any kind of healthcare for its citizens, I suffer because of that. So I have a stake, a personal stake, in what is going on in Washington today and in the coming weeks and months. And I certainly have no hope in the process, regardless of Republicans or Democrats. So that's where I'm at. And so that issue particularly, as well as so many others, are crucial to me. So let's get it started, bro.
Definitely. And this thing doesn't go the way it needs to go. I would strongly advise folks to relinquish citizenship and think about moving to Canada, because this is it's
believe
awkward.
Me, I've thought about that, bro. I've thought about that.
Yeah. So without further ado, as we speak about life and health, I think a good place to start is with this piece, because it has everything to do with life and the taking of life and sanctioned murder and by way of what we call police brutality. And so this is Brother Glenn Ford from Black Agenda Report. That's blackagendareport.com. It's a must read every single week. And without further ado, here's Glenn Ford.
Twice in the space of a week in New York City, the criminal justice system has proven incapable of protecting non-white citizens from a predatory police force. This past Monday, an officer was acquitted of shoving a police baton up the rectum of a young man who'd been smoking marijuana. Two other officers got off on charges of covering up the sodomy attack. One of them was quoted as telling the victim, "You liked it. You liked it." The previous week, federal officials announced that the cops that fired 50 bullets at Sean Bell and two unarmed friends on the morning of Bell's wedding in November 2006 would not face federal charges in the killing. The policemen had already been acquitted in April of 2008 on charges ranging from manslaughter to reckless endangerment, a verdict that provoked a series of demonstrations resulting in the arrest of 200 people, including Bell's surviving friends, his parents and fiancé, and Reverend Al Sharpton. Sean Bell's death reached into the presidential campaign. Barack Obama, visibly ill at ease with the subject, tersely advised that the judge has made his ruling and we're a nation of laws, so we respect the verdict that came down. Obama then counseled that resorting to violence is completely unacceptable and counterproductive. Hillary Clinton's response was more sensitive to deeply felt black anger. "My thoughts are with Nicole and her children and the rest of Sean's family during this difficult time," said Clinton. She continued, "The court has given its verdict, and now we await the conclusion of a Department of Justice civil rights investigation. That investigation has succeeded only in federalizing the whitewash of Sean Bell's killing. The Obama Justice Department, the FBI, and the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Eastern District of New York all concluded that unleashing a 50-bullet fusillade against unarmed men, resulting in death, was not a violation of anyone's civil rights. The Obama administration's refusal to seek justice for Sean Bell through the civil rights statutes should cause us to review the history. The feds began to prosecute killers on denial of civil rights grounds because Southern white law enforcement agencies and juries refused to mete out punishment to racist murderers. Federal prosecutors felt compelled to take the civil rights route because entrenched racism made justice an impossibility in the state courts. More than two generations later, in the age of mass black incarceration, a police state exists on the streets of New York and all our major cities. Police can organize instant firing squads or shove objects up people's rear ends with near impunity. The circumstances cry out, just as 40-plus years ago, for federal intervention. But even the horrifying facts of the Sean Bell case are not enough to move the Obama administration's Justice Department. Sean Bell's family will pursue civil damages. The victim of a police sodomy has already filed a $440 million lawsuit against the city. There's a chance that both will win significant damages. But there is a lesson here for the victims of police abuse. You might eventually get some money, but you'll never get justice. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to www.blackagendareport.com.
And anyone that wants to chime in on this one, please do so. This one, it's really hard for me sometimes to discuss police brutality without getting... I don't know if there's any such thing as being excessively emotional, but so I won't say that. But without getting emotional and the emotion that is usually triggered initially and throughout is that of anger. And it's something that angers me at the very least several times a week. This is deplorable. It's deplorable that in 2010, not only do we have these these attacks on brown skin and black skin people by the state and the police representing the state. It's deplorable in that, but it's also deplorable that these issues are left off the consciousness of much of America. Much of America that doesn't have to deal with this, and that includes these elected officials, these so-called politicians that are out there. They're supposed to be out there to represent folks in districts that are predominantly black and brown skin. And this joke, you know, this clown, you know, known as President Obama, you know, really angers me. And I had my decision made up that I wasn't voting for him way before it became even somewhat fashionable to question this guy by so-called liberals and so-called progressives. But, you know, I was off the Obama bandwagon clearly at the very least about a year and a half before the election of 2008. And because he had given all the indications that he was not the kind of candidate that was going to vouch on behalf of masses of marginalized folks. And for any idiot out there that wants to say that he wasn't going to be president of Black America, you know, I always reply back, low expectation having blankety blank, by your estimation, by your words, you know, clearly black people must not be a part of America because he has not yet once targeted or had any kind of significant targeting of issues that affect black and brown skinned people in this nation. So, you know, Peter, I just want to, you know, and I'll let you, I know you have a lot to say on this, but it was Obama that when the Sean Bell assassination and murder by the NYPD occurred, it was Obama that said just days after, while his wife and his family were still mourning, it was Obama that said in front of cameras, you know, in no equivocation whatsoever, said that we need to, you know, the verdict has been handed down by the judge, and America is a land of just laws. We need to respect the verdict of the judge. And that was one of the most deplorable things I have ever heard, you know, especially for someone that is phenotypically brown skin. That's one of the most deplorable things. And this is the same guy that hangs on to the words and when it's convenient, you know, tries to compare himself to, you know, to Dr. King, or to even evoke that there might be some kind of similarity between he and Dr. King, which there is in no shape, form, or fashion. If that's the case, I mean, basically what he's saying is that in the 60s, you know, it was pretty much law, you know, to hose down black folks, to sick dogs on black women. It was pretty much law to be able to lynch and get away with lynching black people at one time in this country. I mean, there's a lot of laws. And so based on what Obama's saying is that, hey, this is a nation of just laws, which is not, but you need to sit down and stop protesting and be good black folks and let, you know, MASA continue to wreak havoc upon your community over and over and over again, no matter how many lives are lost, you know what I'm saying, not just unwarrantedly, but criminally. That is murder. So that's my take on that, Pete. I don't know what you have to say, but it's really disgusting, man. It's disgusting.
Well, you know, I'll tell you what, Solomon, if you don't get angry about that, then there's something wrong. You know, this is something that, you know, this whole issue, the criminal justice system, police brutality from the top to the bottom, the racism and injustice that runs through that so-called criminal justice system that I call the corporate incarceration complex. But you know, you've got to be angry about that. You know, if not, you're not paying attention. And for Obama to come out and say we've got to defer to the decision of the court or to a judge and we live by the rule of law is inexcusable. And just simply underscores his role as the house Negro who's serving the corporate interests in the ruling class in this country. You know, you want to talk about the court decisions and the and judges' decisions in this country. If we were to abide by that, we'd be in bad shape. I mean, you know, the Constitution itself is a document that condones slavery. And if we look at other decisions of the court, we can just call the roll. We can look at the Dred Scott decision in 1857. We can look at the Fugitive Slave Act. There was one in the late 1700s, and the even more punitive and barbaric Fugitive Slave Act of 1850. 1883, there was a decision that the same court, the Supreme Court of the United States, overturned the Civil Rights Act of 1875, calling it unconstitutional. Then you got Plessy versus Ferguson, and then let's fast forward to 2000, Bush versus Gore. The Supreme Court showed its ass in that decision, and not only that, but simply ignored how the state of Florida, under Jeb Bush and Catherine Harris, how they systematically disenfranchised hundreds of thousands of black and brown skin potential voters in the months leading up to the election. And the Supreme Court decided to ignore that. All the courts in the land decided to ignore that. We didn't hear about that. And then you got 2010, just a few weeks ago, the ruling of the Federal Elections Committee and Citizens United, and the scandal of that decision. So you know that's the Supreme Court in this country. That's the rule of law, the overarching rule of law in this country. And you know if we're just gonna bow and serve that, then we're in a bad way. However, there might be a glimmer of hope. Recently there was a federal court. This hasn't made it to the Supreme Court. You can bet it will be, because it's going to be appealed. But a federal court, in the case Farrakhan versus Gregore, has decided that inmates need to be re-enfranchised because of the undeniable racism in the criminal justice system, all the way from the police on the streets, and that's what we're talking about right now with the police brutality, all the way up through the court system, through the sentencing process, through incarceration, through parole, and whether parole is applied or not. So what we're seeing in that ruling, and that's just from this year, from January of 2010,
yeah,
that's going to get to the Supreme Court eventually.
Mm-hmm.
And the Supreme Court will have a chance to make a ruling, and it's basically going to have to admit that the criminal justice system in this country is racist from top to bottom.
Yeah.
And once it does that, then perhaps there'll be some legal standing to make some frontal attacks, a frontal assault on that racism in the criminal justice system. And if it doesn't uphold that ruling, then we're going to have to take on some different tactics. But one way or the other, I think that's going to be a crucial moment in American history.
Right.
When that comes
up. That's a good point that you bring up, and it's a good segue to discussing that. And folks, if you're listening, I mean, there's you know, we talk about these things, and because they're not discussed on the corporate media airways, whether it may be radio or television. These things are simply not discussed in any kind of significant way. There's no critical analysis, and you know, I think that's part and parcel of their modus operandi, and that's to keep the general populace disengaged and as dumbed down as possible, and also to keep them separate from these real, like very, very tangible and significant things that are going on in terms of the abrogation of people's civil and human rights in this country. And when you do that, you know, folks that aren't even affected by those things in the same manner as another section of people, when they finally do hear about it, since they haven't heard about it in the news, they just kind of assume that this is kind of a novelty, if you will. It's just, you know, and so it's nothing to really take up arms about and to create coalitions with those folks who are being brutalized, who are being murdered, having state sanctioned murder committed upon folks just based on the fact that they're brown or black skinned, and also the wholesale warehousing of people, largely based on race. I mean, we have something called a prison industrial complex. Maybe you've heard of the military industrial complex, where there's something that's been going on a long time called the prison industrial complex, where we've seen a 40 to 50% increase of the incarceration of black people in this country since the 70s. This is the most prison populist country in the entire globe, even more prison populist than China, which holds more than 1 billion folks, citizens. And so, I'm glad Peter mentioned that. That is a very significant case that's going on, and it does present a glimmer of hope. But there has to be a groundswell. There has to be mass organization. There has to be folks that are even on a singular basis, even if they're not a part of any kind of mass organization or mobilization, folks getting onto the computer, filing letters, sending letters, emailing letters to their local representative, bringing these things up and town hall forums, and having the courage to do so. Don't be afraid to be called a rabble rouser or to be called radical or what have you. I mean, even when you looked at these white slave owning men that founded this this nation as we know it, they were considered radicals by the controlling authorities in England. And so radical should not be a term that you escape from in 2010. It's radicalism, it's revolution, it's progressiveness is the only thing that's going to bring about any kind of measured, sizable change that we need to see in our lifetimes. And so I'm going to play this clip because Peter alluded to it, and I think it's important for all the listeners to hear this. And if you know about it already, listen to it again and make sure you send the link to this show to all your email networks. We can send funny jokes and chain mail letters, all the time. We need to take time to send chain emails that have to do with things of some kind of substance and significance. So I would greatly appreciate it, not for my own aggrandizement, because I don't get any money for doing this show, nor does Peter. We do it because we think it's part of our larger responsibility to being good global citizens, not good citizens of U.S., United States of America, but being good global citizens. So here's Glenn Ford again with the felon voting rights issue that's coming up.
Mass black incarceration touches every aspect of African American life, economic, cultural, and political. The pervasive impact of the black American gulag is made even more devastating and intractable because its effects weaken black people's ability to change the system through electoral politics. 5.3 million U.S. citizens are barred from voting because of felony convictions. 2 million, or 38%, are black. Court rulings in cases challenging felon disenfranchisement have been all over the map. But last month, in a case from the state of Washington, a federal court decided that the hugely disproportionate effect of felony convictions on black people's voting rights amounts to a violation of the 1965 Voting Rights Act. The case is being appealed and is very likely to wind up before the U.S. Supreme Court. In the state of Washington, 24% of black men and 15% of African Americans overall are ineligible to vote because of felony convictions. Since black mass incarceration has been a fact of life everywhere in the U.S. for two generations, the facts and principles of the Washington case apply to every state in the nation. The federal court, in a 2-to-1 ruling, declared that there was compelling evidence that minorities are more likely to be searched, arrested, detained, and ultimately prosecuted than whites. In the court's words, if those decision points are infected with racial bias, resulting in some people becoming felons not just because they have committed a crime, but because of their race, then that felon status cannot, under Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, disqualify felons from voting. In other words, since the criminal justice system's behavior at every stage of its interaction with black people, from the stop on the street to the trial in the courtroom, is more likely to result in a felony conviction for blacks, that racially biased system violates black voting rights. The court's conclusion flows from the reasoning of the Voting Rights Act itself. In attempting to outlaw racist Jim Crow voting restrictions, the Congress took into account the wide range of racial practices that had prevented blacks from exercising their voting rights, including poll taxes, literacy laws, and intimidation. The Voting Rights Act recognized that many discriminatory factors can combine to prevent effective exercise of one's rights. The federal court agreed that race was the reason that minorities are disproportionately prosecuted and sentenced, resulting in their disproportionate representation among the persons disenfranchised. The NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund hailed the ruling for acknowledging that the criminal justice system is infected with racial discrimination. That is an understatement. Mass black incarceration has replaced Jim Crow as the principal American mechanism to subordinate and control black people. Finally, a federal court has recognized that the racist infection has also vitiated the right to vote. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to www.blackagendareport.com.
And that piece kind of substantiates and elucidates what exactly the great point that Peter brought up. And that's something that really folks need to keep their eyes and ears and mind's eye keenly focused on, because it has so much to do with our communities from coast to coast. And when I say our communities, I'm specifically talking about communities that you have large populations of black and brown skinned people, because these types of laws, I mean, you know, this harkens back to the convict lease system. They have taken a hold of and have played a significant role in deconstructing black families, and therefore when you deconstruct and tear up black families by removing the man, or in many cases the woman from the household, based on these draconian laws that have been put in place by pure racism, it slowly and surely deteriorates the community, and the fastest prison population in America is black women, you know, and that's kind of a shocking piece of data for a lot of folks, but that's true. So, Pete, any last comments?
Glenn Ford mentioned he framed the mass incarceration of blacks as the new Jim Crow, and you know, it's a book we should commend to those listening, called The New Jim Crow by Michelle Alexander, who's a professor at The Ohio State University, my alma mater. And so that book touches on and goes into detail about that whole process. And you know, when we can look at the explosion of mass incarceration of black America going back to the 1970s, especially looking at the police response, the state's response to the civil rights movements and the black power movements that sprung up around civil rights in the mid and late 60s. And there was a concentrated and organized effort by the federal government to disrupt and implode those efforts for black liberation. And, you know, the Black Panther Party is probably the best example of that. We know that the federal government was interfering with and trying to disrupt the civil rights movement by getting on Martin Luther King and eventually allowing him to be assassinated. Same thing with Malcolm X. The Black Panthers, you know, they don't get as much pub in American media because they're not as easy to sanitize as Martin Luther King is. But nevertheless, we look at the Black Panther movement, and why did those movements die? They were murdered by the U.S. government through a police state brutality that resulted in not only a number of their leaders being murdered, in addition to King, Malcolm, you know, Fred Hampton, Mark Clark. Look at those, the leaders who were imprisoned, Huey Newton, Clee, all those brothers, and Brett Brown. the list goes on and on and on. And those are just the ones that we know about, have been written about, and so forth. There are countless other brothers who are still in prison, political prisoners in the United States. And so, you know, what we saw was the criminalization of dissent, really, of black people organizing. And essentially that became the criminalization of blackness. You know, and that's the reason those struggles died. You know, they were murdered by the U.S. government. And the massive prison industrial complex has become the preeminent vehicle for the continued repression of any liberation impulses. And the influx of drugs and guns, again, that's courtesy of the U.S. government. And that stimulates the drug and gang cultures, which provide the justification for mass incarceration of non-white people. You know, and it creates a kind of proxy control system, particularly as black and Latino gangs are murdering each other in the streets. They become a form of proxy control for the government. Mm-hmm. And so what we need to do is we need to understand that it's the same domination system. It's the same ideology of control and oppression that perpetrated the transatlantic slave trade, the horrors of chattel slavery, alongside the systematic extermination of Native Americans. It's still in charge today. It's the same system. It's just the tactics have changed, and maybe the rationales have changed. And the ultimate irony, Solomon, is that the face of it has changed in terms of who's in charge. We have a black president. That just shows you how deranged this whole system is, man.
Right, and a black president who just this past week, has committed himself and his administration to the tune of, it was something of 20-something plus billion dollars to the building for the building of new prisons and more law enforcement. And the reason this is very much in tune, lock and step with what Peter was just talking about. I mean, we're talking about an administration that just committed itself. And when you have this commitment of these many billions of dollars, it comes from the top on down to the building of more prisons and more law enforcement. And the key thing to remember this is that as we talked about this thing called the prison industrial complex, there are privatized prisons that are obviously they're privately owned. They're on Wall Street. You have the Geo Groups that used to be known as Wack and Hut. You have the Corrections Corporation of America, which is the largest owner of private prisons throughout this country. Matter of fact, they even own in Texas detention so-called illegal immigrant. I say so-called. I emphasize the so-called illegal immigrant detention centers. I just don't even understand that term, illegal immigrant, and as it applies to the United States of America. But that's huge. It's a huge story that very few people are able to put in any kind of context, because usually people respond back, Peter, by saying that, we need more law enforcement. And so this whole but do we really need more law enforcement? When you look at, for instance, New York City, where people think of since 2000. Crime in New York City has decreased. Crime in general in this country, you know what I'm saying, has decreased. Yes, well, you have hot flares and pockets, this, that, and the other, and violent crime is bad no matter where it is. And yes, that should be a goal for society in general to eradicate that across the board. But when you see a decrease, in like a city like New York City in crime, and you see it, but you see an increase in law enforcement presence, and you see with that increase, you see hundreds of thousands of black and Latino men each year in New York City being stopped and frisked, you know what I'm saying, just on the streets of New York City where they walk, where they reside. This issue.
It is clearly, and you know, the let's get tough on crime. You know, that's just a slogan. You know, that's just it's part of the brainwashing. But when you look at the facts, when you look at the raw facts of how many of people who are incarcerated in this country for nonviolent drug-related offenses, including first-time offenders, the numbers are staggering. You know, so we're talking about the criminalization of marijuana and possession and use of insignificant amounts of marijuana. Folks are spending years in prison for that. You know, and so we're not talking about, you know, the enforcement of crime and keeping people safe and all that stuff. That's just the facade that's been built up, the, you know, the image that's been created. It's wrong. You know, it's nonsense. So we need to look at why people are getting locked up. We need to look at the social preconditions that make for criminal behavior. You know, we look. It's no coincidence that, you know, the economy is an indicator of crime. The education in this country is an indicator of crime. You know, how are they going to build prisons on? You know what they base it on, bro? They base it on the scores and the grades of our children in our public schools, because they can demonstrate that, you know what, you know, the dropout rate correlates to a certain number of incarcerations, a certain number of lockups. So that's what they're basing on. And we have a substandard educational system, and a disastrous. I mean, the rates. Look what's happening in the black community during the economic meltdown of the last couple of years. It's devastating. It's depression level unemployment figures in the black community. And then the other side of that is. Is it any coincidence that the explosive numbers in the incarceration rates have also coincided with the end of the Cold War? A lot of those Cold War contractors then turned their attention and their construction to building prisons and providing the food for the prisons and providing the equipment and just all the gear for all the corrections officers. It is a massive and lucrative, enormously lucrative industry in this country. So make no mistake about it. It is financially driven by profit. You know, you mentioned the for-profit prison industry. No question about it. It is a massively lucrative industry. And at the same time, we have a kleptocracy, is what we live under. I mean, you look at what's happened with the massive transfer of wealth from American taxpayers, the working class, to Wall Street, the bank financiers. I mean, they've stolen our money, is what they've done. That is a criminal action on a massive scale. But they're considered heroes. You know, they're considered good businessmen.
We have
a real problem with how we decide and define what crime is in this country.
Exactly, and those you know, contrarians that may be listening and or what have you, or people that have ill intent for black folks in this country and just think that we do crime at a higher rate or we do drugs at a higher rate. You're an absolutely an idiot that does not like to look at the fact. The facts are, black people and white people do drugs at about the same rate. However, what's interesting is that even when you look at cocaine, you know what I'm saying, and you look at, you know, so we said that they do drugs at about the same rate. But yet, black people represent more than 70% of new cocaine-related, you know what I'm saying, convictions. More than 70%. That alone lets you know that something is rotten in the state of Denmark. Something is rotten in the U.S. of A. Something is wrongfully amiss, and the root is in terms of let's not candy coat it. It is rooted in institutional racism. It is institutionalized racism. No ifs, ands, buts about it. Especially when you look at the fact that black people represent about 13% of the overall population in this country. You know what I'm saying? And white folks represent better than 65% of the population in this country. You can't with a logical eye, with a logical mind, you know what I'm saying? You see past race as a major factor in this. You simply can't. But this is continually, Peter, continually left off of any corporate television station. completely left off. No critical analysis. You have this boneheaded, you know, segments that folks have around, like, entertainment. You know, even on, like, the so-called, like, liberal MSNBC, you know, they have, like, an entertainment session where they'll spend, like, you know, better than 15 minutes on you know, looking at you know, different, you know, peccadillos of the stars and this, that, and the other. Meanwhile, people are being killed, you know what I'm saying, unwarrantedly in the city where these studios are housed, you know, New York City. It, you know, where people are being brutalized and being warehoused, and there's no critical analysis, because you know what, Pete, that's part of the plan. Keep them disengaged, absolutely. keep them dumbed down, and you know they, you know, and those that don't get warehoused because of the lack of equal education in these schools, we're very much in an age of separate and unequal. You know, we know that the school system is as desegregated as it was in the 60s. That is a fact. That is a fact of life. You cannot ignore it. And when you look at the amount of money that is put into black and, you know what I'm saying, and white schools, when you compare and contrast the two, it's not even close. And people say, oh, you know, and yes, you know, it's just rotten to the core. It's just rotten to the core. We can get into the whole ridiculousness of property taxes and how they, you know, play a major role. We can get into the militarization of black and brown skin schools, whether it be Chicago or New York City, and then we can look into how those that don't get warehoused make good viable soldiers to be sent to these illegal wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and yes, I will say Pakistan, because the CIA is operating covertly there, dropping missiles from manless drones operated from places like Nevada. So, and speaking of that, I think this, Pete, is a great, speaking of as we have, we're talking about the CIA, and we're talking about the root of Afghanistan and Iraq, we look to the so-called war on terror. And I think this clip right here should raise the eyebrows of some folks.
If the Patriot Act had been in effect when the Free South Africa movement was in full swing in the 1980s, hundreds of thousands of Americans would have been liable for imprisonment on charges of rendering assistance to terrorists. When it comes to civil and political liberties, the U.S. is a far less free place than it was a generation ago. On February 23rd, the U.S. Supreme Court will hear arguments on the scope of the Patriot Act's ban on rendering support to organizations designated as terrorist by the U.S. State Department. The Obama administration's interpretation of the law, like its predecessors, is so broad it could put American citizens in prison for engaging in almost any contact with any person the government linked to a designated group. This includes organizations that have never attacked the United States and have no direct grievance with the United States. It's all in the language, the interpretation of the statute. Justice Department lawyers claim it's a violation of the Patriot Act even to file a friend of the court brief on behalf of an organization on the list. In the case before the High Court, the U.S.-based Humanitarian Law Project insists on its right to help mediate conflicts among peoples abroad, such as the Kurdish people's struggle for national expression and self-determination in Turkey. The Law Project wants to assist in finding a peaceful solution to the conflict between the Turkish government and the Kurdistan Workers' Party. But the Kurdish party is on the American terror list, and the administration contends that even doing peace work with the Kurdish group amounts to assisting in terror. Once on the list, Americans are banned from virtually any contact whatever with the designated organizations. It should be noted that the Kurdish Workers' Party has no fight with the United States, has never attacked American installations, and is a secular party not connected with Islamic fundamentalism. The New York-based Center for Constitutional Rights argues that Americans are being prevented from exercising their free speech rights to promote peace in the world. In some ways, the post-9/11 political and legal climate is worse than in the bad old days of the McCarthy era, almost 60 years ago. Back then, said veteran civil rights lawyer Ralph Fertig, it was not illegal to help communists or to be a communist. You might lose your job, you might lose your friends, you might be ostracized, but you'd be free. Today, Fertig told the New York Times, the same person would be thrown in jail. Imagine then, if the Patriot Act had been in force in the 1980s. Ronald Reagan had placed the African National Congress of South Africa and the world's most famous political prisoner, Nelson Mandela, on the State Department's terror list, from which they would not be removed until the year 2008. Yet hundreds of thousands, millions of Americans offered every assistance possible to the liberation movement, including, or so he claims, Barack Obama himself. Yet the Obama Justice Department is just as eager as the Bush regime was to wield the Patriot Act as an awesome weapon of fear. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to www.blackagendareport.com.
Peter, any comments? I'll let you take this one first.
Well, you know, the war on terror, bro. You know, where do you start? Where do you start in deconstructing that fraudulent lie that's been concocted by the Bush administration and has been upheld loyally by the Obama administration? And, you know, we go back prior to the 9/11 situation. I'm not going to call it a terrorist attack because the U.S. government was complicit in it. There's no question, you know, there's no refuting the facts when looking into 9/11. But, you know, that's how it was set up. That the whole war on terror, the invasion of Iraq, Afghanistan, and the further scope of that plan was established years before what happened in New York City and at the Pentagon. In September of 2001, years before that. So the whole thing is built on a lie. So anything that comes out about the war on terror now is built on a lie. It's a house of cards. So, you know, there's no validity, there's no truth, there's no reality to anything that is framed in terms of the war on terror. It is a further justification for the erosion of civil rights at home and for the expansion, the limitless expansion of global capitalism around the world. You know, in other words, primarily American corporations basically being funded by the U.S. military to go into resources around the globe and basically take whatever resources they damn well please to take. And as long as we say it's for the war on terror, they get a free pass. So, you know, it's totally bogus. American citizens need to wake up to that fact and refuse to accept that. You know, and if we haven't learned anything, and obviously we haven't, because we lived through the Red Scare. And Glenn Ford, you know, he was quoting that brother talking about how it's worse than the era of McCarthyism. But apparently we haven't learned that. We haven't learned a lesson. We have been doomed to repeat the same things, and it's worse than McCarthyism, according to some observers. I didn't live through, you know, the 50s, and I can't really say, but, you know, growing up in the 70s and the 80s, yeah, man, I knew about that. You know, to say you were a socialist or a communist, you know, that was fighting words, you know, as far as good Americans or the U.S. government. And so now we've just replaced that with terrorists. We haven't replaced it. It's still a bad thing or a bad word to say that you're a socialist in this country, but it's even worse to say sympathetic to those who are considered to be terrorists. I mean, for us to look at the Iraqis and the Afghanistans and even now the Pakistanis and the folks in Yemen, what they're doing, a foreign government has invaded their country. All right, the U.S. government has invaded those countries, unprovoked invasions. And so what we're doing, we're calling those folks, those brothers, those freedom fighters who are fighting for their own freedom, trying to oust a foreign invader from their homeland, they get labeled terrorists. And if we sympathize with them or their movements, the women and children who are being slaughtered by the U.S. military, if we sympathize with them in any way, shape, or form, that we get lumped together, given aid to terrorists, it's absolutely fraudulent. It's scandalous.
Right. Right. What's funny is who's not called a terrorist is
that's
one of the things that jumps out at me is that, you know, just a couple of days ago we had these hearings. These congressional hearings where you had folks from Blackwater and its subsidiaries, you know, facing a barrage of questioning based on the fact that there has been, you know, that these truths have come out recently that Blackwater employees did everything from going on shooting rampages while they were drunk in Afghanistan. We know what they did in Iraq, you know, when they went, they opened up in the open-air marketplace where they took the lives of 17 unarmed, innocent civilians in Iraq. But, you know, is that a big story here in America? No, we don't give a damn because those are Iraqi people getting killed and slaughtered, and it's not some kids in Columbine getting mowed down, you know, where we have, obviously rightfully so, attention put on that, but why isn't the same attention being put on, you know, 17 Iraqi civilians being mowed down by Americans, you know, under the guise of the Pentagon and CIA, you know, the U.S. government in general. And so we see that with all this out, President Obama felt the need to award them a contract. You know what I'm saying? Award them a contract in Afghanistan, and that's where they have been. That's where they have been since he has been in office. So he basically renewed their contract. They were kicked out on their, you know what I'm saying? They were kicked out on their ass by Maliki and even though Maliki is a U.S. puppet, but kicked out on their ass by the Iraqi because he knew he had to do that because the people were demanding that. They kicked him out of Iraq, and beyond that, you know, the Obama said, "Yeah, I'll just renew your contract and stick you in Afghanistan." And they're going there and they're doing the same thing. These night raids and all this, and there's all this other stuff. And what I found funny is you have folks like Claire McCaskill grilling, which what's interesting, what is amusing, Peter, is that you have folks like Claire McCaskill, senator from Missouri, grilling these individuals as if she like gives a damn. Maybe she does, but I just find it very ironic and hypocritical that she's grilling them, but at the same time, she was also the person that was one of the most vociferous Democrats when the ACORN when it came time to saying that ACORN should not receive any government funding for the situation that they had where an ACORN employee was found to be, you know, helping out somebody who disclosed himself as a pimp and a prostitute and so that happens, and yet the entire ACORN organization needs to feel the brunt. We're going to take the money out. And don't tell me it doesn't have anything to do with the fact that ACORN is a community-based organization that is firmly, predominantly situated in communities of color and has mobilized a lot of black people from city to city to be registered to vote. You can't tell me that it has anything to do with that, but this lady wants to get on her high horse and talk about this, that, and the other, and at the same time, you know, allowing these billions of dollars to be sent to the coffers of these private military, like mercenaries from Dying Corps to Blackwater, which is now known as ZXE, you name it, you know, across the board, and has no problem whatsoever. Halliburton, even though they're not private mercenaries, but Halliburton has done more damage in terms of U.S. tax dollars has in my estimation has done more damage with their whole illegal and non-bid contracts that they've received over the years, and than Acorn has ever done. And this is all with U.S. tax dollars. And it's just amusing. But, yeah, they needed to be grilled, yes. But those senators that were grilling them, you know, such as McCaskill and a couple others who really were so outspoken about Acorn, they need to, like, step up and publicly repudiate themselves. But that's not going to happen. No, they won't.
I mean, that whole Acorn debacle was a straw man. It was something for the U.S. government to say, well, we're taking a stand on this. But what it demonstrated, what they did was, you know, they were basically the conservatives in this country, you know, snapped the whip. And the government, you know, the government responded, and they went after this this organization, as you mentioned, that works in communities of color, low-income in communities. So, you know, that demonstrates the disposition of the ruling class in this country. You know, it's not appropriate, it's not acceptable to help out people of color, to help out low-income people in this country. Just like it's not acceptable to have any kind of sympathies for the Iraqis and Afghans that are being slaughtered just obscene numbers, in obscene numbers, and the millions that have been displaced from their homes, and the horrors of war that have been going on for nearly a decade now. It's not acceptable. So, you know, they make it very clear where they stand. They make it very
not
clear
at all.
Where they stand.
Exactly, and not at all. You're exactly right, and Pete, as you allude to that, I mean, it's really important that I play this piece because, you know, as we are immersed in Black History Month, and those who don't know the history, you know, was founded by the great Carter G. Woodson, who spent pretty much his entire life celebrating and promoting researching the history of people of African descent, and he's the founder of Black History Month. It started out with, you know, in his lifetime, started out as Negro History Week in 1926. And now we have it as Black History Month, and it's really important that we remember that this whole, like, what Peter and I are doing, speaking out, what Glenn Ford does routinely with his Black Agenda Report, that is all in the essence of Black history. That is Black history that must be told, even though it's not popular to be told in mainstream public institutions such as schools and so forth and mainstream corporate media. But the struggle, the story of resistance in the face of white supremacy, in the face of racism, in the face of terrorism, you know what I'm saying, from the U.S. government, people of African descent have always resisted. There have always been a critical mass of people who have resisted, from the Denmark Vessies, to the Gabriel Prossers, to the Africans in South Carolina in the Stonewall Rebellion, to Toussaint Louverture, Jean-Jacques Dessalines, the great strength of the people of Haiti, fighting off and defeating the so-called Le Grand Armée of that little midget named Napoleon. And so it has always been in the DNA of people of African descent to resist and to speak out and what I want listeners to really grasp is that, you know, the great Martin Luther King at one time said, you know, and to paraphrase it, he said that those that know of evil that is going on and choose not to speak out against it, if you know of evil and wrongdoings that are going on, you choose not to speak out against it, they are as guilty, as complicit, as those who are perpetrating those evils. And so it's vastly important that we make it a popular thing to do, to speak out. The more you do it in front of folks that have been prone to follow you, whether it's been your family or your classmates or your friends, speak out. Speak truth to so-called power. Speak out. Make it popular. The only way it can be made popular and the popular thing to do is if we all do it. Right now we have this thing where, you know, we don't speak out, not even as half as much as we should. And so I think this is a very, and I know, Pete, you're going to dig this one. You didn't know I'm going to play this one, but this you're going to dig this little tidbit right here. So, people, I want you to really put on your listening caps right now. Listen loud and clear. This is Black history.
A time comes when silence is betrayal. That time has come for us in relation to Vietnam. Religious leaders have chosen to move beyond the prophesying of smooth patriotism to the high grounds of a firm dissent based upon the mandates of conscience and the reading of history. As I have called for radical departures from the destruction of Vietnam, I come to this platform tonight to make a passionate plea to my beloved nation. Connection between the war in Vietnam and the struggle I and others have been waging in America. A few years ago, there was a shining moment in that struggle. It seemed as if there was a real promise of hope for the poor, both black and white, through the poverty program. There were experiments, hopes, new beginnings. Then came the build-up in Vietnam, and I watched this program broken and eviscerated, as if it was some idle political plaything of a society gone mad on war. And I knew that America would never invest the necessary funds or energies in rehabilitation of its poor so long as adventures like Vietnam continued to draw men and skills and money like some demonic destructive suction tube. So I was increasingly compelled to see the war as an enemy of the poor and to attack it as such. Perhaps a more tragic recognition of reality took place when it became clear to me that the war was doing far more than devastating the hopes of the poor at home. It was sending their sons and their brothers and their husbands to fight and to die in extraordinarily high proportions relative to the rest of the population. We were taking the black young men who had been crippled by our society and sending them 8,000 miles away to guarantee liberties in Southeast Asia, which they had not found in Southwest Georgia and East Holland. And so we have been repeatedly faced with the cruel irony of watching Negro and white boys on TV screens as they kill and die together for a nation that has been unable to seat them together in the same schools.
And to back that up, to put that back to back with somebody who is often paired in the same discussion as they like to contrast the two, but at the times of their deaths, they were actually more on similar footing than they were on dissimilar footing, and that is Malcolm X. I want to play his piece, and then after this piece, we'll deconstruct this.
So, if you want to investigate something, find out why they stopped building Harlem Hospital. There were people in Harlem fighting hard for a long time to get that hospital built. Had a hard time getting the white man even to start it. Then when they finally started on it, and there's nothing you need in Harlem more than a hospital, because you're sick, and you just got cut, or you're just getting ready to cut someone else. And we needed that hospital. So all these people had a brainstorm. They got up there and picketed and demonstrated, and the white man took away all the workers, stopped the work. As someone said earlier this afternoon, they're still being paid, and the hospital is not going up. Your money, the money you pay out in taxes, is paying the white construction workers who are sitting at home doing nothing. This is some brainstorm that someone got off the track on when they tried to stop the construction of the hospital in Brooklyn. Couldn't stop it, because that hospital is for white people, primarily, and you are not going to stop construction where the white man is to benefit. The only thing you're going to stop is something right here in home. But what really stopped the work up there, too many of y'all was out there, and the white man is free to you. Long as the line up there was Cora originally started the picketing, and there were more whites picketing than blacks, nobody was worried. Plus, they started picketing on a cool day, and our people don't come out when it's cool. It was on a Wednesday, I think, and it was cool. And then on a Thursday, everybody came out there. They weren't demonstrating, but they came out there as spectators. And when all these black people as spectators began to stand there and watch, they were afraid. Because they knew that with the picketers picketing, any little thing could happen. And even though you don't want to integrate, if the white man started beating some integrationist heads across the street, you couldn't stand there and watch it. Your nature wouldn't let you do it. And this is what would make you explode. He knows that. So he stopped the building of the hospital, but they have not been successful in bringing a halt to any other construction in the city of New York outside of Harlem. So if they really meant good, they could have stopped that building over there in Brooklyn. That you can bring a halt to all the construction in New York City if those preachers are really for real. All they got to do is take all their congregations and take them down to Times Square. Tie it up. Now, I'm not talking Muslims aren't going to do this, but go and do something. And don't care what it costs. Don't care what the penalty or the price is. When you know you're right, you're right. And if you're not willing to go all the way, don't even start. Get on out of the line. Get on out of the battle. And that's another reason why we don't picket with you. As Reverend said, we're not nonviolent. We have demonstrated. We pull a demonstration. But when we demonstrate, if you ever see us fall out in a demonstration, we are ready to die, or we're ready to see that someone else die. I don't mean no turn the other cheek. This is the only reason that we don't become involved in these nonviolent demonstrations. It's not fair to walk up to a man nonviolently and he got a club in his hand. You're out of your mind. So you should check and find out what started, what stopped, who is behind, and what are the leading men I saw out there that day was a white man named Herbert Hill. Herbert Hill is the labor secretary for NAACP. Now, Herbert Hill, a white man holding a top position in the NAACP, can come to Harlem and stop the building of a hospital that for the benefit of black people, if that white liberal really has your welfare at heart, let him go downtown and stop some of these other construction sites. And until these white liberals, white people, who call themselves liberals, can go into their own neighborhood and stop construction, don't let them come in Harlem and start telling you what to do. No, when you want, if they want some action, you give them some action. And you'll bring about a change in your whole, in the entire direction of your program and of your struggle, and you'll get a job done. We want every black man and woman to have freedom, the freedom to accept or reject being separated from the slave master's children and establish a land of our own. And this is what he says. Give all of us freedom of choice. First, give every one of the 20 million black people in this country an opportunity to hear the truth. Let them be taught the truth about the white man and the truth about the black man. Let them be taught the truth about God and the truth about the devil. Let them be taught the truth about heaven and the truth about hell. And once they know the truth, then give them a chance to make a decision. But don't take this poor, dumb, deaf and blind, ignorant, brainwashed, so-called Negro and ask him what he wants. He doesn't know what he wants. And because he doesn't know what he wants, he tries to integrate with a blue-eyed wolf. Don't you know anytime you see some sheep trying to integrate with wolves, those sheep are sick. Those sheep are out of their mind. And a sheep got more chance with a wolf than you got integrated with a white man. Why, a wolf can't be as hard on a sheep as the white man has been on you here in America. We want an immediate end to the police brutality and mob attacks against the so-called Negro throughout the United States. Yes, a complete end to the police brutality and mob attacks that our people are confronted by every single day, every single week, every single month, every single year across the land. Brother, show me those. I got those pictures. Brother, grab that picture of Brother Ronald. Let me show you what I mean by police brutality. and mob attack. Come over here with that. Here is a man, a Korean vet. This is a black man, a Korean vet. Went to war in Korea fighting for America. Risked his life fighting for America. And came back to this country and was shot down by the white man like a dog. Not some Ku Klux Klansman down in Mississippi. This black man was shot through the heart by policemen in Los Angeles, California. And they are dumb enough to think we have forgotten it. We are Muslim, never forget. You don't kill our brother. We don't never forget. You don't shoot one of us and then grin in our face. You don't shoot one of us and then shake our hands and think we forget it. No, we never forget. We'll never forget. Someone has to pay. Somewhere, somehow, someone has to pay. When a snake bites your children, you don't go and look for the snake that has blood on his jaws. Any old snake will do. Any old snake will do. They shot him through the heart. And as he lay dying on the sidewalk, they beat that hole in his head with police clubs. Not in Mississippi, but in Los Angeles, California. Not in the South, right there in the North, in the West. Here it shows, men, black men, laid all over the sidewalk, shot down by police bullets. Not men who were guilty of some crime, not men who were drunk, not men who attacked anyone, but they shot their way into our mosque, shot their way into our religious sanctuary, and got the audacity to walk around here talking about this as a country based upon the principles of freedom of religion and freedom of worship and freedom of speech. This country is based upon nothing but hypocrisy, and it's based upon nothing but the right of white people to mutilate and shoot down black people. This is the brutality that we're talking about. This is the crime that we're talking about. And you say we teach hate. What kind of hate are we teaching? We're telling you what happens to black people. And this man didn't get shot down because he was a Muslim. They didn't ask him what his religion was. They saw that he was black and they began to fire point blank. And then when they went to court, these Gestapo, they were the criminals. They didn't go to court. They charged him. He's a dead man. And they charged him with a crime. But these Negroes here, shot down, were charged with a crime. And you haven't heard anybody open their mouth about it. You wonder why you're having trouble in this country. You're having trouble because the devil is on the rampage. A blue-eyed devil is on the rampage. A heartless devil is on the rampage. A beast is on the rampage. And you haven't got sense enough to know how to handle them. So we don't try and handle them. God is going to handle them. We ask God to give him justice. We ask God to trap him. We ask God to catch him. We ask God to deal with him. And we pray that God deals with more of them day after day. Right. And what ones God don't get, we'll get them.
That was, gosh, that brings a tear to my eye. Those, jeez, man. Man, oh, my gosh. They just don't make them like those two anymore. Martin Luther King and the great El Haj Malik El Shabazz, otherwise known as Malcolm X. Peter, I'm almost in tears, so I let you talk. I'm overcome by emotion, man. I love those two,
yeah,
men. Oh gosh.
Yeah. I tell you what, man. Just listening to either one of those brothers, just get chill bumps, man. So where do you start with that? Let me say one thing before we. Touch on them. You talked before we went to the clips about the resistance in this country, black resistance in this country, and then earlier we talked about the entertainment media and how that that's such a distraction. And because it's Black History Month, I also want to it's also germane. Let me mention two books that I would consider essential reading. Understand the history and the legacy of black resistance and the struggle for black liberation in this country. It's an anthology, so a collection of relatively short readings from a variety of different sources going back in history. The name of the book is, write this down, Let Nobody Turn Us Around, Voices of Resistance, Reform, and Renewal, African American Anthology. And there's two editors, Manning Marable, and Leif Mullings. All right, just look it up online, an African-American anthology under Manning Marable. It'll come up. And the other book, that's germane, based on what we just listened to, a book called Martin and Malcolm and America, A Dream or a Nightmare. You know, we need to be students of both of those brothers. So that's a great resource on both of those brothers. All right, those clips. You know, Martin Luther King, he came out publicly against the Vietnam War in April of 1967. And so that marked a drastic change in his disposition, and his ethics and his tactics, and his focus, really, because his whole disposition towards the United States of America had changed, certainly from the beginning of his public ministry in 1955, but even since the March on Washington in 1963, where he delivered that speech now known as I Have a Dream. And see, that's where, in the public mind, we want to distill Martin Luther King, keep him chained to 1963 on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial, where he's talking about I Have a Dream, and he's talking in terms of holding hands and singing We Shall Overcome, even though there's some very radical elements to that speech that get ignored. But we see it completely different, or I should say a transformed Martin Luther King in 1967 and into 68 before he was assassinated. That he comes out and he speaks against the United States of America. He had changed drastically over the course of his ministry as he got to see the realities of brutality of the system of white supremacy in this country. And so that's the voice that we heard in that clip, was that Martin Luther King, who had been radicalized and even further politicized than he had been, you know, and then we put that together with the clip that we heard from Malcolm. And what we see, the continuity there, are that both of those brothers are challenging the structural problems in the United States. Now, we like to think about Martin as a preacher, as a Christian, and we think about Malcolm as a Muslim. Well, you know what? They were religious individuals, but what they're talking about, their public ministries, were dealing with structural problems in the United States. And listen to both of them in those clips. They're not calling folks to kneel. Malcolm wasn't telling people to kneel and pray to Allah. Martin wasn't telling people to bow and pray to God. They were urging people to get politicized and to act structurally and to organize and to make change on a structural political level in this country. And you know, it's no coincidence, bro, that Malcolm and Martin met one time, and it was a coincidence. It was an unplanned meeting. They met in March of 1967. They were both in Washington, D.C., to sit in the gallery while Congress discussed the civil rights legislation. So, you know, we can see where they were at later on in their lives, and we need to pick that up. That's a lesson for us. Understand where they were at, pick it up, and apply it to today. So,
Very much so, and I totally agree. And it looks like we have a caller. Before I, you know, click over to the caller, it, both of them, you know, to me is just, I mean, it's so inspiring. And sometimes I often like listen to, you know, speeches, you know, from everyone from Martin to Malcolm to even listening to the strength and the wisdom. In the words of Fannie Lou Hamer, have some powerful speeches by her as well. It's resistant. I listen to it as, like it's game tape, the same way athletes, you know, watch game tape to prepare themselves for the day. I mean, I listen to that and it's powerful stuff. It's resistance laden. It's logical. It makes so much. It's pragmatic. And it's strength. I mean, it's strength personified in these human beings, man. These human beings that oftentimes, you know, exuded so much strength and resistance and power and intellect that sometimes it seemed like they were inhuman. But you know, it's just interesting that like you know, I can imagine, only imagine what Malcolm would be saying now, you know, when we look at, we were talking about terror and how, you know, how people are labeled as terrorists, and what Martin would say, you know, about, you know, the white man that flew his plane into the IRS building. If you notice that the media, mainstream corporate media, was very hesitant to call him a terrorist, because because they had built up this boogeyman over the last several years since 9/11. They had built up this boogeyman. This boogeyman was Muslim. You know, it was a man. You know, he was brown skinned, and to label this white man, which what he did, when you read his manifesto, it's out there. I read his manifesto, the letter that he left. His manifesto was everything. It was premeditated. It was a terrorist act. And because he was white, because he could be the guy next door, they didn't want to confuse people with what they had already built up in people's heads and their subconscious of what, you know what I'm saying, a so-called terrorist looks like, what you know, what they want him to look like. And they don't want a terrorist to look homegrown and to look white and to look like it's someone next door and to, as I repeat again, to look white. So yes, it gets me amped up, because that is the nefarious nature of this white supremacist country that we live in, because it doesn't just permeate. White supremacy is not this friggin' guy that looks like Remy from Higher Learning, you know what I'm saying, who has a swastika in his back of his head, or looks like Ed Norton in the beginning of American History X. That is not, you know, white supremacy is this. It is how the mainstream corporate media is able to shape the faces and the images of terrorists to look only brown skinned. And I guess with the Christmas Day Fruit of the Loom bomber, you know what I'm saying, to now to be able to make, you know, to keep him black as well, because after all he was Muslim, and that's what they want. And so without further, we have a caller, you know, so I want to I think this is a great moment to get folks calling. I see someone calling from Bowie, Maryland, it says on the switchboard. So Bowie, Maryland, you are on now. Hello?
Hi. How you doing, Coleman?
Oh, how you doing? Oh, Jessica.
Yeah. I listened to the show, and after I heard Malcolm speak, I just had to call in. Just incredible words, and it almost sounded like he was talking about, you know, Sean Bell or some of the other things. I mean, because nothing has changed. But to hear that kind of thing, that type of response, especially, you know, with the leadership now, I mean, I just wish we could hear out of someone that's out there today. We have this president who's just a marshmallow.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, he just has no spine. He can't fight for anything. He can make speeches, but he can't get anything passed. You know, just like you said, he went and disgraced the black community by saying that you know, we're a nation of just laws. So, oh gosh, you know. That speech really hit me.
Yeah, it's very, very
inspiring.
Yeah.
Definitely.
What do you think, Desta, might be what's your optimism? Do you have any like optimism, and if so, what do you think can radicalize folks, you know, especially like, you know, looking at within the black and brown community, for them to be awakened and to see these snake oil salesmen for what they are, and more importantly to see them for what they are, and to be able to mobilize and to organize in communities, and to, you know, and to join up with organizations that are radicalized and mobilized, such as the Black is Back Coalition. What do you think it's going to take to wake folks up and to pull them away from the Democratic Party and to pull them away from these scoundrels such as Barack Hussein Obama?
That's a very good question, and something that I've been thinking about for a while. You know, a lot of people say that it takes, you know, a big disaster for people to wake up. And we had that in Katrina. And black people, you know, in 2005 were saying, oh, yeah, this is how the government feels about us. You know, we're only second-class citizens. You know, in 2008, after the election of Barack Obama, we're saying that, you know, we've arrived. We are a government. And all types of this crazy, this madness. It's just, it's ridiculous. This is mental illness. Any person, especially a black person who says that we're in a post-racial society, like you say, no such thing as a post-racial society. It would be racist. If a black person says that, they're just crazy. White people have actually been saying that for the last 40 years. So I'm not even surprised when they say that kind of thing. They're just looking for any type of opportunity to reaffirm it. But that's what they believe anyway. I was in African-American studies. I read some reports that in the 60s, white people thought that things were equal. They never had a firm sense of reality, even today.
Right.
That's a really hard decision. Very hard thing to answer. I'm not really sure what it's going to take because I think even if some type of Hurricane Katrina type event happened under Obama's administration, people will still be defending him. I think we just need to get as many people educated as possible on what role the government plays in everything. And just you don't have choice here. And most people, I'm not sure if most people will ever really get it. I really don't know. The key thing is to go and organize and give people an alternative.
Right. The one last question I have to ask you, and also can you if you could turn the volume down in the background, we're getting a little feedback from your phone. As we talk about mobilization in the organization, and one of the things that you know, and when it happens within the black community, it's definitely not trumpeted on the corporate media the same way when you have these mental midgets, you know, known as the teabaggers, you know, and that white nationalist movement. I mean, they're splattered all over the place. But when you have black folks organized politically, like a Black is Back coalition is not put out there. My question is we have to move on to the next story. If you could actually, it's more of a comment, and if you could talk to the listeners briefly about what you're doing, because you are a student at a very large university, University of Maryland. If you could talk about what you've done, what you've been doing week in and week out and day in and day out since about a week after January 12th earthquake in Haiti, you've been organizing around a very important trip that you're about to take. What is the trip about? What are you going to do there? And if you could, you know, leave your email before you get off the program, because I'm sure that I see that we've got a lot of folks listening right now. Maybe some of them might want to tune in. They might have some kind of financial wherewithal to help them, because I know that at this time, because the university has pulled back from its initial pledge to help you guys, you could use some financial help. So what's all this about that I've been alluding to?
Well, I'm really happy you asked, Solomon. Basically, I'm helping to lead a delegation of students and non-students down to Haiti for our spring break, which is going to be March 13th through March 20th. And the purpose of our project isn't to go and save Haiti, like a lot of these other people are trying to do. The purpose of our project is to go and work in solidarity with them and introduce a new method of building shelters called EARTHBACK buildings. And basically, EARTHBACK building is a remix of ancient building styles that use dirt, put in the same type of bags that you put rice in or sandbags and so. And so you stack them up on each other and you can create temporary and permanent structures. And so as soon as the earthquake hit, actually even before the earthquake hit, I was planning on utilizing some of these types of buildings in a lot of developing countries. And so I saw this as a prime opportunity to go down there and help introduce this type of structure, because, you know, the type of conditions that people are living in, even before the earthquake, weren't fit for human habitation. So, you know, we definitely want to go down there. We're getting trained on how to do it. And we're going to go down there and teach them how to do this so they can go and help themselves, because You know, when a lot of people don't realize aid doesn't really help anyone. It can only feed people from day to day, but, you know, they need assistance. They need assistance. They need solidarity. So we're approaching them like equals. And the name of our coalition is the Rebuild Haiti Today Coalition. And our website is rebuildhaititoday.org. And we definitely would appreciate any type of financial help, because the university at first had agreed to help us, and I've heard no response from them in a couple of days, which is essentially them saying they're no longer going to do it. And, you know, we need all the help we can get. So, again, like I said, our website is rebuildhaititoday.org, and my email is destiny@gmail.com, which is D as in David, E as in Edward, S as in Sam, T as in Thomas, A as in Adam, N as in Nancy, Y as in yellow, @gmail.com. And my number also is 301-905-6834, and that's 301-905-6834. And, yeah, we definitely appreciate any type of help we can get. Appreciate the shout-out, Solomon.
No problem, and thanks for calling in. Thanks, appreciate it.
All right.
All right, talk to you soon.
Bye.
And that's really inspiring. And, I hope folks that are listening, if there's any way, even if you don't have the economic wherewithal, I know this is a tough financial times for all of us, so it's but if you do have the financial wherewithal, definitely reach out, call the brother. You know, he left his number and his email. Give him a call. And if you just even have just moral support or logistical support that you might have as an elder to bequeath upon a young adult, you know, college student, then, you know, same thing. Get on the computer, email him, or pick up the phone and call him. You know, these folks are doing some amazing stuff, and this is the stuff that's not trumpeted around. And this was, you know, it was completely, entirely led by black students. Now, there are also, like, white students that are part of this delegation, but this is a delegation that was led by black students. And I think it's just very impressive. And in that vein, I think it's important to play this. This is something that just happened last week. Has to do with another political movement that we need to hear about. We need to hear about a lot more than the teabaggers. And I'll get Pete's take on this on the other end.
The United States ambassador to Haiti is claiming that the U.S. military takeover of that stricken nation is a model for American behavior in the world. If so, then the world is in great trouble. Let's make our response to Haiti's humanitarian and political crisis a model of solidarity with the victims of natural and man-made catastrophe. On Saturday, February 20th, join with the Black is Back Coalition for Social Justice, Peace, and Reparations in Miami, Florida, for a national mobilization in defense of Haiti. Haiti doesn't need a U.S. or United Nations occupying army. Her proud and long-suffering people deserve a massive human response to their material needs, and they deserve solidarity in their struggle to regain national self-determination. Haiti's future must be shaped by her own people, not by the occupiers that stole her independence, banned her most popular political party, exiled her president, massacred her most dedicated community activists, and laid her economy naked to foreign exploitation. Haiti's dignity must be restored, along with her ability to feed, house, clothe, and govern her own people. Join with the Black is Back Coalition on Saturday, February 20th in Miami, to declare that solidarity with Haiti does not come out of the barrel of U.S. guns. Demand all U.S. troops out of Haiti and the return of President John Bertrand Aristide. A free and independent Haiti can only rise under the democratic direction of Haitians themselves, not under the guns of U.S. neocolonialism. The Americans pile one crime against Haiti upon another, and then try to justify their illegal occupations on humanitarian grounds, while calling themselves benefactors and role models. What hypocrites and nation-stealers! The U.S. and France owe Haiti billions in reparations for their raw thievery of Haitian national resources, revenues, and rights over centuries and to the present day. On February 20th, in Miami, demand that the debt be paid so that Haiti can be rebuilt along its own model for the benefit of the Haitian people. Washington claims to have Haitian interests at heart, but makes Haitian refugees persona non grata on U.S. soil because they are black and proud. The Black Is Back Coalition demands that Haitians be treated the same as Cubans when seeking entrance to the United States. The U.S. pretends to be a model, but it is a model of racism. If Washington has empathy for Haitian poverty, then it should stop charging an $80 fee for Haitians to apply for temporary protective status in the U.S. Haiti owes the United States nothing and never has. It is the U.S. and France that owe Haiti. The least the Obama administration can do is to cause the World Bank and other financial institutions that it controls to erase Haiti's debts and remove all restrictions on trade and aid to Haiti. If Washington truly wants Haiti to recover from the earthquake, it must get its boot off Haiti's neck. Join the Black Is Back Coalition on Saturday, February 20th in Miami in defense of the Haitian people. For more information, go to www.blackisbackcoalition.org. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford.
That's what I'm talking about. That's what I'm talking about. I know it happened on the 20th. The march was on the 20th, but I felt that we needed to play that clip that spokes knew, you know, this about this movement, this Black Is Back political organization, you know, and movement for peace, justice, and reparations, and also, you know, more importantly, looking at the scope of what Haiti owes the U.S., which is absolutely nothing, but the U.S. and likes of France owe Haiti billions of dollars in reparations, and they need to, you know, saying to immediately alleviate and wipe clean the debt that Haiti, you know, illegally, you know what I'm saying, owes the U.S. So, Pete, what do you have to say?
I tell you what, you know, we can't. I'm glad you played that, even though it was after the fact of the rally in Miami, because we can't let Haiti out of our consciousness. You know, I think one of the problems with the debacle in New Orleans is that it's dropped from the popular consciousness in many cases. You know, it kind of got swept off of the news, but New Orleans is still a disaster area for so many people. There's still a lot of native New Orleans residents who have not been able to return. Much of particularly poor and black New Orleans has not been rebuilt, and so on and so forth. And so we can't let that happen with Haiti. We can't let Haiti and the debacle and the disaster and just the human catastrophe in Haiti slip off of the front burner. Just because the calendar goes on. I mean, the scope of that catastrophe, it's been considered by some to be the worst natural disaster ever in terms of its toll in human life and in material wealth, homes and businesses and buildings and so on and so forth, ever in the modern world. So, you know, I'm glad you played that. I'm glad you're keeping that in front of us and in front of the public, because we need to keep Haiti in front of us and not let the vultures of American capitalism and the U.S. military just sweep in there and let us get us convinced that everything's okay, and for us to just, you know, let them handle it, because, you know, the way they're handling it is obviously the wrong way. And you know, one of the things Glenn Ford said that's crucial is that the Haitian recovery must be led by Haitians. You know, not by Americans in fatigues, and not by American generals, and not by the U.S. military, not even by the U.N. It must be immediately demilitarized and handed over to Haitian leadership. Get the military, anybody's military, whether they're wearing whatever uniform they're wearing, they need to get out of Haiti now. And like you said, the reparations all that money, all the money and the resources that are being committed to the militarization, which is really the it's an occupation of Haiti at this point. If that were liquidated and turned into resources for the Haitian people to use at their own discretion, that would be an authentic response. And so, you know, what Black is back, what they're about as far as Haiti is awesome. And that coalition itself, the Back is Black coalition itself, demonstrates a genuine, independent Black-led movement. Their focus isn't just Haiti, but you know that's an obvious point of attention. But the Black is Back coalition represents a genuine independent Black-led movement in this country, and it's something that you know maybe we need to talk to Glenn Ford about how to replicate that across the country. You know, because not all of us could be in Miami, and not all of us can be you know on the East Coast where Glenn is, but maybe we can replicate that in other places. So that's something that we all need to be supporting as time goes on. And what I see that the possibility there, Solomon, is for the Back is Black Coalition to be the potential organizing principle around which Black people, people of color in this country, all folks begin to organize around. You know, you put a question to Desta in terms of, you know, how do we organize? What are we going to do? You know, there's no simple answer to that complex question. But, you know, organizing principles are crucial and identifying them. And if we can look at the Black is Back Coalition as an organizing principle in the fact that it is independent, when I say independent, I mean independent of the corporate political party in this country, Democrats particularly, as well as Republicans, obviously. And so we need a body like that. We need a movement like that. And we've seen that the NAACP obviously cannot do it.
Right.
The Urban League, that's not even their mission statement to try to be that. You know, so looking at what Black is Back is doing, not only in the United States but in Haiti is crucial. We need to keep that in front of us.
Yeah, you're exactly right. It's you're right, and I wasn't gonna do it, but you pulled me into this to this clip that wasn't gonna play, just not because it's not a great clip. It is a great clip. It's just based on time restraints. But we have 12 minutes left, but I think this is a very important clip to play, and I'm glad that you brought it back.
I'll take the blame.
Yeah, you take the blame, but and take the credit as well, because I think you mentioned it. I mean, you said it with it's not going to come from the NAACP, and it's vastly important. And like I said, how powerful that would be on any given day that there are, you know, 4 or 5 or 10 major demonstrations across the country organized by the likes of something like Black is Black or another, you know, very, very progressive, radical organization. I mean, we saw what the Greeks did, you know, in terms of like their oh my gosh, their economy has gone to hell in a handbasket, you know, with a political party and a president that came to power on a socialist wave, but then sold his country out to the likes of Goldman Sachs and you know, and other Wall Street bank, you know, banksters, and we see what Greece is going through now. They've raised the retirement age from 60 to 63, and they've frozen assets for public workers. I mean, it's just a mess. I mean, you're either going to go all the way, you know, you're either going to ride a socialist wave, or you're not, or either you're going to ride and stick with capitalism. But I don't think you can come in on a socialist wave and then go turn to uber capitalist. But people have been in the streets, and they've been protesting for what was a criminal act on the part of their government. And so Pete did it. Pete instigated, Pete instigated a fight with the NAACP. And so I'm going to play this clip, and we'll hear Pete defend or not defend himself and continue to rail on the likes of the NAACP. But I think that he, you know, Pete can play cleanup hitter because I think that Glenn Ford right now is gonna play leadoff man and fill the bases.
Let's do it.
When NAACP Chief Ben Jealous emerged from a White House meeting with Barack Obama last week, Jealous told the media, "What's clear is that we have a president who gets it. Barack Obama gets it all right. He gets it that organized black leadership is grateful just to be allowed into the presidential presence. Obama gets it that so-called civil rights leadership is terrified of even the appearance of exerting pressure on, or, heaven forbid, making demands of, the first black president. Obama gets it, as he always has, that he can treat the civil rights establishment like fools, and they will dutifully oblige him by acting the part." By their own accounts, Ben Jealous, National Urban League President Mark Morial, and Reverend Al Sharpton spent much of their hour with President Obama discussing ways they can help Obama garner Republican support for his programs. This is deep, deep farce. The three black civil rights figures have virtually no influence on Republican Party politics. That's not their constituency and not their job. The expectation was that Sharpton, Jealous, and Morial went to the White House on behalf of black people, among whom they theoretically have some influence, to pressure Obama to take stronger action on depression-level black unemployment. Instead, they leave the meeting babbling about helping the president with Republicans, but with no larger commitment in hand from Obama. The president himself declined to make any statement concerning the meeting, an indication of its relative unimportance in the White House scheme of things. In fact, the three civil rights figures have been spinning their wheels and wasting everybody's time. They seem most giddy about having clarified to the White House what black people mean when they cry out for action on reducing black unemployment. "This is about place, it's not about race," rhymed the NAACP's Ben Jealous. Government jobs programs targeted on the cities would effectively bring down black unemployment, since black people reside disproportionately in the cities. "Nobody is demanding that jobs be created specifically for black people," said Jealous. But that's always been the case. There has never been a serious legislative proposal to create black jobs. That's a red herring created by Barack Obama himself. It was Obama who replied to every question on black unemployment by saying he would never support any specifically black jobs program, even though no one was asking for one. Obama was setting up a straw man, a black demand that did not exist, in order to knock it down. His purpose was to impress white people by appearing to be standing up to black folks. Through this dishonest and despicable ploy, Obama succeeded in deflecting criticism on black unemployment for over a year. Now, Ben Jealous says the president gets it. But Obama still hasn't come forward with a serious jobs plan for the cities. Black people have been demanding a Marshall Plan for the cities in every election in the past 40 years, except for the election of 2008, when blacks made no demands at all on candidate Obama. And the NAACP, the Urban League, and Al Sharpton still cannot fix their mouths in the shape of a demand, a pitiful excuse for leadership. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to www.blackagendareport.com.
Couldn't have said it better myself, but I give you this one, Pete, in 2 minutes or less, can you give your feedback on that?
Yeah, you know what? Yeah, I'll tell you, well, first of all, Glenn Ford, again, is spot on, you know. And, you know, for them to come out of there and say this is about place and not about race, what does that mean, Solomon? What does that mean? And I'll tell you what, what that does is betrays the fact that they're sitting in a pretty good place. Those three brothers, Morial, Jalas, and Sharpton, they're all sitting in a pretty good place. If they looked at the rest of Black America and a whole lot of the rest of America, they'd see that we're not in a very pretty place at all. But, you know, to sum it up, if there's any question about where the NAACP leadership is, folks need to go to the NAACP website and look at their new Black History page. All right, you and I have talked about this already, and you know what I'm talking about. Folks need to go and look at that and see how they frame Black history and who some of the people are that they consider to be players in Black history and their sellout to the corporations in order to put out a Black history product. You know, that's all we need to know about that, man. That's all we need to know about it. And what it does is it further underscores what I had said earlier about the need for an independent Black-led movement, a politicized movement, because those traditional organizations certainly don't have the capacity to do it, nor the will to do it, and in some cases, you know, it's really not even in their mission. I'm talking about the Urban League. It's just not something that they're about. You know, so go look at what they're about. Look what they're doing. You know, but let me, you know, there are some good people. There's some great individuals, some class individuals working in those organizations at the local levels across the country. I've worked with some great people who work for the NAACP and the Urban League in different places. But I'm talking about the leadership and the movement and the trajectory of that organization as it relates to being independent from corporate politics, the politics of the Republican and Democrat machines. That's what I'm talking
about.
Right.
Definitely. And if you look on it, I mean, Death, I know you get a kick out of this if you're still listening out there somewhere. If you just go to the NAACP's website and you look at their Black history timeline, it's I'll just tell you, they have Ronald Reagan up there.
Under what heading? Under the Lost Heroes of Black History.
Yes. They have Ronald Reagan. They have Bill Clinton. These are the likes of folks that they have, and they even have George H.W. Bush, you know what I'm saying? I mean, George W. Bush, I should say, the mental midget, the last one, mental midget, George W. Bush. They have him there, and he was next to H. Rap Brown. Oh, my, you know, yes.
Yeah.
So, I don't know how many, you know, folks, just go see it for yourself. Please tune in next week. I want to give us time to be taken out by non-corporate backed hip hop song by Wise Intelligent called "Weapons of Mass Destruction." But Pete and I want to thank you thank you guys all so much for tuning in. We want to thank you even more for taking this link and sending it to all your networks so that you know, you can hear the insights of myself and Peter Fowler and Destanuel and everybody else that's tuning in, because this is the information that has to get out there, not because we're putting out there, but because it's vital information that needs to be heard by the masses. You know, we're just doing what's our job. When you read books or you acquire information, you don't read it for yourself. You want to utilize it in some way, but one of the best ways to utilize that information is to take it and to give it to other folks, to take it and disseminate it to other folks. You don't read to try to walk around and brag that you know, I've read 60,000 books of this, that, and the other. You read so you can disseminate it to the masses, and that's what we're trying to do. So here's Wise Intelligent, Weapons of Mass Destruction. Thanks a lot, Peter. Peter will be with us again next week.
This is a lesson, complete with plans and actions, a combatant of all the weapons of mass distraction, the iced-out gems that cost us peanuts in comparison to the Africans that lost their limbs. We're dumb to what's happening with George W. Bush and his corporate American cabinet, the waging of war, which amounts to nothing more than strategic positioning on a global chessboard, the axes of evil, imaginary enemies configured to gain the support of an apathetic people. with war comes spoil. What Afghanistan, Iraq, and Colombia have in common? Drugs and oil, lucid commodities. Whoever controls the two upset the balance of power and influence world economies. Any DJ that want to lose his job will play this. And any MC that want to get dropped off your label, say this. I will not comply. This is what life is. Terrorists have prices to bring about change through contrived crisis. Terror for hire. Freelance extremists who carry out what your government conspire. But this rhyme is not political. It's commercially defective yet extremely critical in violation of the Patriot Act. Because my freedom of speech is being breached and I have a problem with that. George W. and the bush from which he came is rotten. When he started Albusto Oil, his business partner was Salam bin Laden, the elder brother of Osama bin Laden, the two wealthy sons of the late Mohammed bin Laden, entrepreneur extraordinaire. Now who dropped the put options on United Air? Any DJ that wanna lose your job, play this. Any MC that wanna get dropped off your label, say this. I will not comply. I am slightly left. I might swing on a right-wing extremist. I am an introvert. I fit the profile of a genius. I spit venom. Bush saw the towers fall before the planes went in them. Bush saw his father's poor finance Hitler system. I am a dead man walking. I'm destined for the coffin. Judas has already been paid to stop me from talking. I have never been afraid. I embrace this war. You have not yet lived until you find out exactly what it is that you were dying for. Don't say this, don't say that. Change your lyrics. Everybody's a critic. It's getting kind of hectic. My rhymes are authentic, so they shall remain. My writing exciting and ever mundane. In actuality, my personality keeps my mentality based on real life situations, not speculations, but verbal illustrations of how I feel. Holla. Intelligent Music. IntelligentMusic.com. The music with a Z and a K. MUZIK.com. IntelligentMusic.com. Have more suggestions. Black Lion Media Group and the whole nine. Let's just keep it moving, man. Support the strugglers. I mean, they're in the struggle. You gotta support the strugglers. If there ain't no struggles, you ain't got no struggles.